often say there's nothing more ex than an ex-politician. Rarely do they successfully make re-election bids. Some quietly fade into the background, some write books, some stay bitter. And then there's Ed Balls, the former Shadow Chancellor in the United Kingdom who's confounding the critics and rewriting the rule books by dancing his way into voters' hearts. Here's our Europe correspondent, Lisa Miller. This is funny.
This is a story about a reality TV show and a former politician, but it's also a tale about repairing reputations and rejuvenating careers. Don't worry if the name Ed Balls means nothing to you, or if you've never caught a glimpse of Strictly Come Dancing. The lessons here have global appeal.
Dancing for Sandra from the movie The Mask, Ed Balls and Katia Jones.
Ed Balls was Britain's Shadow Chancellor when he lost his seat in last year's election. He was the equivalent of Wayne Swan when Peter Costello was Treasurer, or in current terms, Chris Bowen. He was one of the most powerful men in UK politics over the years, considered a brilliant economic strategist, but a bully boy bouncer for the Labour Party. So imagine the shock when he turned up on the BBC's weekly dancing competition, almost bursting with the excitement on launch night.
After the general election, I thought to myself, what would I really like to do now? I've got a bit of time, and coming on Strictly is dream come true for me.
It might have been a dream come true, but from his very first performance, even Ed Balls knew he was no good, that he was just a dancing dad embarrassing his kids.
It was pretty traumatic watching that. I'm not sure whether I was more traumatised by my dad's moves, which looked rather more kind of dad-like than I expected, or the pictures of me with all these sparkling celebrities and me looking like the guy who's about to serve them the drinks in this bow tie. It was...
you were more formally dressed than the rest.
I was a bit more formally
dressed.
But
at least you had slimmed down dramatically for the event.
Well, I'm expecting to slim down dramatically over the next few weeks.
Really? It's going to be an on-air slimming process.
Look, I could have decided to spend the last month and a half slimming and dance practicing, but that wouldn't be consistent with the spirit of the show, isn't it? I think you've got to go in as you are, which for me is slightly overweight and with no dancing ability at all, and then hope that Katia, my fabulous partner, is going to wreak a transformation.
Each week, the judges veered between being in awe of his bravery and despair at his lack of talent.
You haven't taken the easy option. You could have easily, which we've seen with many maybe less talented dancers, you know, the pro is doing everything. But no, you've given Ed four routines with lots going on.
Lots.
And it's just great to see you out there having a go. Well, Ed, you're not the best dancer, but you're definitely the most fun.
And so, show after show, he and his professional dance partner are at the bottom of the points ladder, but keep surviving because of the public vote. Everyone's talking about it, even the former Labour leader Ed Miliband.
He's brilliant, isn't he?
Have you been watching?
I have. I watched a clip, actually, of... he's got better and better, hasn't he? There he is.
Do you think he's got better and better?
Well,
what are you basing that on?
Well, didn't he do better last week than he did the week before?
He's definitely thrown himself into it a little bit more. He's slightly less embarrassed.
National treasure.
Ironic, isn't it? The man dumped unceremoniously from politics is discovering he's on a winner. It might help to put this in the context of Britain's current politics. The Labour Party has been through a tumultuous period and would likely face massive losses if there was a general election now. Its leader, Jeremy Corbyn, is deeply unpopular amongst his own parliamentary party. And here is a former Labour Party frontbencher gyrating in glitter and winning over fans. 12 million viewers tune in. Even the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown emailed words of encouragement. Keep going, Ed Balls, they all urge. One commentator wrote that the mix of his political experience and the ability to pull out a credible samba means Balls might just be the man to turn things around for Labour. I asked a friend of mine to try to explain this phenomenon. She said that as a deeply depressed Labour member, she was simply pleased to finally see somebody succeeding at something. Perhaps that's why Ed Balls, despite his desperately terrible dancing, has captivated the country. I sought out the advice of a team of experts. better known as the four television-watching daughters of a friend.
He's making a fool of himself.
And why do you think he's making a fool of himself?
Because he went from holding a really high position in Westminster and now he's just on
and
a kind of reality TV show.
Why do you think he keeps getting back each week when he's clearly so bad?
Well, some people say that Tory voters are, like, keeping him on because it just discredits the Labour Party further because he's a bit of a joke and it makes them seem like they're not taking themselves very seriously.
Surely there's not a political conspiracy going on behind Ed Ball's success. By the time you're listening to this, he may well have gone back to being a feather duster. But he'll have left a mark, perhaps convincing jaded voters that politicians are humans too, or that they can suffer a midlife crisis just like anyone. Or perhaps they simply know when a bit of samba can be smart politics. This is Lisa Miller in London for Correspondence Report.
Construction has just begun on the landmark building in Port Moresby that'll host the leaders of some of the world's biggest economies when they go to PNG in 2018. It'll be the first time a Pacific Islands country has hosted the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation or APEC summit. But while the PNG government is spruiking the benefits, plenty of people are worried about the cost. Our PNG correspondent, Eric Torchek, reflects on both the benefits and the risks for PNG as it tries to step onto the world stage.
Port Moresby's most recognisable place is probably Ella Beach, a strip of waterfront between the downtown area and a traditional Motuan village built on poles out into the ocean. It's home to shady casuarina trees, plenty of stray dogs, basketball and beach volleyball courts, and women behind ad hoc barbecues who sell greasy sausages and lamb flaps for family picnics. This dusty, friendly place is about to be transformed, the trees cut down and replaced with roads and the sand pushed further out to sea. Three men shoveling earth into the ocean marked the start of that process the other day, a symbolic ground-turning ceremony for the new APEC House Convention Centre at one end of the beach. The night before, the site had been covered in people and smoke. The people were gathering the huge amount of plastic waste which had washed ashore and were burning it in piles. Guests walked past the smouldering remains the next morning. The ceremony was on a small artificial peninsula which used to house a large red water slide. Every weekend, groups of kids would climb the rusting metal frame and use old plastic bottles to pour water down the slide so they could slip into the sea. The slide's been demolished, and an earth mover now sits at the site, waiting to start work on the $50 million building, which will host the Pacific leaders in November 2018. The Papua New Guinea government is paying for the construction by foregoing tax revenue. It's probably the single biggest cost associated with the summit. The Minister for APEC told the ABC at the launch that the total cost of the summit would be at least $240 million. After the ground-turning ceremony, Papua New Guinea's opposition leader, Don Pollier, called for PNG to give up the hosting rights, saying the country simply could not afford APEC. The economic situation has changed since Papua New Guinea took on the task. When Port Moresby was granted the hosting rights in 2013, Papua New Guinea had an impressive growth rate and was expecting huge revenues from a new gas project. Those revenues never came. The Papua New Guinea government is about to hand down its 2017 budget, and it's already warned of further cuts to overall spending. In that climate, it could be hard to keep justifying the inevitably significant cost of hosting an international event. So what seemed like a great idea for a young country full of confidence is now at risk of being seen as a liability in an increasingly tough economic climate. I'll miss watching the kids on the water slide and playing basketball at Ella Beach, but proponents would argue such changes are the price of progress. Everyone in Papua New Guinea will be hoping it's worth it. From Port Moresby, this is Eric Torchek for Correspondence Report.
Relations between India and Pakistan are never warm, and recently they've taken a turn for the worse with escalating violence in contested Kashmir. The area has been fought over for nearly 70 years after what's known as partition. Now there are just a handful of people still alive who remember a different time before the conflict began. Our South Asia correspondent James Bennett met one while doing a story about cricket bats in northern Punjab.
On a factory floor in Jalandhar in Punjab, workers shape cricket bats by hand. Watching over them is 85-year-old Ramesh Kohli.
I belong to a Kohli family. My father and uncle started a company called Beetall Sports in the year 1935 in Sialkot, which is now West Pakistan.
I'd gone to meet him because he's trying to import Australian willow to make bats with, but frustratingly getting nowhere with bureaucrats. His personal story, however, is remarkable, covering a key period in Indian history. Ramesh Kohli makes it all sound as simple as moving house.
After the partition, we shifted to India. We started our business in 1948. Since then, we have been manufacturing cricket bats, hockey sticks, footballs, and exporting all these items all over the world.
What happened during partition, when the British left India in 1947, is one of history's grisliest passages. Grossly abbreviated political rivalries between the Hindu and Muslim leaders with whom the British were negotiating for independence convinced them to split their empire. India for the Hindus and Sikhs, and carved from it from the Muslims, East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, and West Pakistan, now just Pakistan. The Kohlis found themselves part of the largest mass migration in human history. 10 million people who had lived side by side scrambled to shift.
We left our house and all the belongings were left over there. So whatever little we could carry was the clothes and the suitcases, maybe a little bit cash, but most of the things were left over there.
The haste was driven by fear. Amid panic and anger at such upheaval, violence gripped Punjab, fueled by animosity and a thirst for reprisal. Stories abound of horrific violence, refugee-laden trains being ambushed by mobs. Estimates vary wildly, but anywhere between several hundred thousand up to 2 million people are thought to have been killed.
I was 12 years. I had full memory of what happened. And I've seen a lot of blood shed during Sialkot to Amritsar in the train. And then we saw what's happening in Amritsar, all the bloodshed. I had the memories of that.
Ramesh Kohli's family, however, survived.
After 21 days in a military camp, then we were brought to Amritsar. And from Amritsar, we went to Agra, where we had the contacts. And we stayed there for 2 years, but then we came back to Jalandhar because Jalandhar was the place where we had the labour.
Mr. Kohli's father and uncle started from scratch, rebuilding their business, which has since supplied bats to India's most revered cricketer, Sachin Tendulkar. Ramesh, too, was working his way up through the firm. Then, 2 decades on, an opportunity arose.
I went to Pakistan after 20 years, so I still remember where my house was. So I went to the lady living over there was a very nice lady. She also went from Jalandhar. She was also one of the sufferer of the partition.
So she went the other way?
She went the other way. And when I went to see it, she said, why have you come? I said, just wanted to have a look at my house. She was such a nice lady. She said, this is your house. You can come and stay over here. So there are good people in Hindus. There are good people in Muslims.
Cross-border respect is in short supply at the moment. Rising military tensions over Kashmir have flowed into society. India and Pakistan have banned each other's films, actors. Even cricket is not immune. Indian batsman Gautam Gambhir said this week he couldn't think about playing Pakistan in such a climate. That saddens Ramesh Kohli.
I keep telling everybody there are very good people in that community also, because people don't like Hindus and Muslims, but I don't think you have to be a good human being, whether you are a Hindu or whether you are a Muslim.
Ramesh is still sharp and sprightly for his 85, but as the 70th anniversary of partition looms, his generation of Punjabis aren't getting any younger. When they go, a human link, a thin strand, still connecting people so similar, yet now so divided by politics and history, will sadly be severed. In Punjab, this is James Bennett for Correspondence Report.
If you're not a video game player or a gamer, as they say, the whole world of computer games can seem a little alienating and weird. Our Tokyo reporter Rachel Mealy decided to meet her fears head on.
So I've made it to the grand old age of 41, knowing very little about the world of gaming. I remember when our neighbours in Brisbane bought an Atari in 1982. I played it a few times and liked the colours and the noises. But my parents weren't the kind to spend money on home entertainment. We'd only just talked them into a colour television in 1982, so an Atari for us was probably some way off. Fast forward a few years to when I was in a group house in Sydney and my housemate brought home a console game over a rainy Easter weekend. I played it and I was terrible. Every time it came to my turn, I'd drive my car over a cliff and I soon lost patience with the whole thing. Now here I am living in and reporting from the video game capital of the world. Japan has always been at the forefront of the development of video game technology. Companies like Sega, Sony and Nintendo have dominated the market. When I took over this job for the ABC in Tokyo, I knew the day would come when I'd have to report on the latest in video game technology. So while I'd be happy to go live on air in 5 minutes and report on the political upheavals of the Abe government or the impact of the negative interest rates in Japan, my biggest professional fear was the humble video game. And so there wasn't any way I could avoid it any longer. The Tokyo Game Show was coming. It's held every year at a convention centre on the way to Narita Airport. The convention itself takes up the space of about 5 aircraft hangars. It's a swirl of lights, noise, and, well, let's get straight to it, weirdness. There are people walking around dressed as the characters from their favourite games. They've come here in groups and they're posing for photos with other groups of similar characters. I am lost in a strange world. Video game reviewer Brian Ashcraft has been coming to the Tokyo Game Show for years. He says the fans come here to see new games unveiled or play new versions of games that haven't hit the stores yet.
And you're going to see lines for like Final Fantasy 15 and other titles that are going to be several hours long. You know, people are going to line up for hours to play something for, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. So I think for me personally, you know, as a member of the press, you get kind of jaded, you know what I mean? Because you just expect to get the demo and play the demo and move on. And so to see people who travel all the way here, stand in these long lines and wait hours and hours and hours to play these demos is amazing. I think it's like really, it's like, well, they really love video games. I think that's fantastic.
So I'm still trying to figure out what the story is going to be about amidst all the hurly-burly. I ask Brian Ashcroft about what's next for fans of video games. Where is the technology heading? He says that mobile phones have taken gamers in a new direction. Even I've heard about Pokemon Go. But next is the advent of virtual reality or VR gaming in the comfort of your own home. One of those big companies I mentioned earlier is about to release a virtual reality headset which plugs into a home console. Brian Ashcraft says the new goggles can take you to another world.
To be honest, I was kind of jaded about VR, but I played about maybe one or two games, maybe more, that have really changed kind of the way I thought about it. And if it's done right, it's amazing. If it's done wrong, it makes you sick.
David Gibson is the head of research in Japan for Macquarie Capital Securities. He says this year's VR headsets are the first generation and a little overpriced, but the technology is here to stay.
This show here has over 100 VR games for people to demo. It's a coming real to market. Now, it's not going to take off like Pokemon Go. These are items still $300-$400 each. So until the price comes down, it's not going to be mass adoption, but we're still going to see a several million units sold over the next couple of years.
For the first time at this year's game show, there was an entire exhibition hall devoted to virtual reality. Within that hall, many exhibitors were displaying virtual reality units with haptic feedback, or haptics for short. I walked up to a booth and strapped on a wristband. When I looked into the virtual reality goggles, I saw a bird. The man at the booth told me to gesture to the virtual bird and invite it to come and land on my virtual hand. And as the giant virtual falcon flew towards me, my rational brain knew that the bird wasn't real. But when it landed on me, I made this sound. Yep, I'm a convert. It felt like a bird had actually landed on me. So, from this very experienced video game reporter, you heard it here first. Haptics is the way of the future in gaming. This is Rachel Mealy at the Tokyo Game Show for Correspondence Report.